This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a club?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for you.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you ain't wanted, Ennis. So what we got now is broke right now.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening, in advance of World AIDS Day next month, we are turning our attention to the representation of HIV/AIDS in cinema. So quite a meaty and really a tough topic to deal with.
I think, you know, and Daniel, as I said to you earlier, it was a tough topic in the lead up to the decision this week. We're all feeling a bit...
Exhausted?
There are so many words we can use.
It's been tough going.
It has.
But as you were saying, really timely as well.
Look, really timely, because I know when you set some of the homework, I was like, oh my God, I don't know. I don't know if I can put myself in that position to watch these films. But one of the films that, you know, you made me watch again and I love...
Is that this an accusation?
Oh, no, you know what? I love this documentary and we'll be talking about it later. We were here and there was an interview with the filmmaker, Daniel Weisman, and it kind of summed up... It was actually the films I needed to watch this week.
Yeah.
Because there's this gorgeous quote when he's talking about why he's making that documentary and why he's telling that story... And trying to make sense of what the community was going through. And here we are trying to make sense of what our community is going through. I mean, it's not, no extent.
We're not comparing.
No comparison whatsoever. But, you know, it is kind of that we will continue to go on no matter what anyone throws at us, no matter what anyone does to us. We will take care of each other and we will continue to go on. And again, there is no comparison whatsoever. But it was kind of... I almost needed to see these stories again.
So what did he say?
We'll read out. Basically, he said, amidst terrible horror, life still goes on. And that was him explaining why he made the gorgeous documentary, We Were Here, which we will speak about later tonight.
So we are turning our attention to the representation of HIV/AIDS in cinema. That is a really broad genre. There's a lot of films, so we're not going to be tackling the full genre. That is actually something that we've done in the past. Actually, one of our first episodes, we had Dion Kagan on the program, an academic at Melbourne University, hosts a podcast, prolific writer. We had a chat with Dion about the way that cinema has tackled HIV/AIDS, in particular the experiences of gay men, and we ran the gamut from the early or mid-80s with something like an early Frost in 1985, which I think was one of the first, that was actually a made-for-TV movie, really interestingly, and the way that those early kind of representations dealt with HIV/AIDS through to new queer cinema in the early 90s and the kind of simultaneous popularization or
Hollywood representation,
democratization of HIV/AIDS in films like Philadelphia and subsequently in the early thousands with TV shows like Angels in America and, of course, Rent. And then later again...
Dallas Buyers Club, thank you, 2013,
So there really has been a development of the way that HIV/AIDS has been represented from the aggressive kind of political representation that we saw from Greg Araki, say, in The Living End in 1992, through to something like the Dallas Buyers Club, which is a Hollywood blockbuster film. Well, perhaps not a blockbuster, but it kind of ticks all of those Hollywood blockbuster boxes.
Well, it did with casting, then we can assure the audience that. But when
that was very controversial at the time.
It was very controversial, but it's funny to hear you say that kind of those political films, which another film we're going to touch on later today is After Louis, 2017 film featuring Alan Cumming, which is a deliberate political film. It has a deliberate message.
It's directed by Vincent Gagliostro, who was actually a founding member of ACT UP. And we had him on the program when the film screened at the Queer Screen Film Festival a couple of months ago. So we will revisit that chat, because I think what his film does and what We Were Here does, and indeed what All the Way Through Evening, a film by Rowan Spong, which will be spotlighting.
Speaking with Rowan later. Yeah.
So I think what these films do is they take us to a new kind of place in terms of AIDS and HIV representation.
But also of memory, I think, is the thing.
Well, that's
of
it.
Grief.
So these are films that deal with the grief of the past and remembering the past, and that imperative that we all have to, that, you know, we must not forget, we must remember. And also this kind of attempt to grapple with what happened.
Yeah.
Because, of course, HIV/AIDS is still an issue. It's an issue that needs to be addressed today. But, you know, the crisis of the 80s and 90s is something that as a community we are still grappling with. And we are starting, I think, in the last 5 to 10 years to see films that actually critically interrogate the memory of those years in the 80s and 90s and what the community went through and the trauma that we as a community still deal with.
And that's the thing. It's that trauma that is still with us. And I think After Louis, as we said, we'll talk about it later, is still dealing with guilt and trauma of surviving, of surviving that time and losing so many people amongst, and saying to a younger generation, why don't you remember, you know, why can't you understand what we went through?
But After Louis, as much as it does all of those things, also critically interrogates memory and how destructive memory can be, but at the same time how important it is, and how do you kind of delineate,
and for the and for every different player in that field. So different friends will come at something very differently that experienced the loss of a friend or a partner. And that's what I really liked about that story.
So I think we are starting to see representation that is slightly different. These are not films that take us back to the 80s and kind of re-dramatise what happened then. These are films that are set today about people grappling with what happened back then. And certainly a very worthy documentary that does that is All the Way Through Evening, which deals with, I think, really the importance of memory and asks how can we remember, you know, what can we do to remember and to pay our respects to all of those people who lost their lives during the 80s and 90s. And, of course, the documentary, we're going to talk about this in more depth when we have Rowan in the studio shortly. Mm. It's kind of spotlights a pianist called Mimi Stern-Wolf and her wonderful kind of year-long endeavor to keep the memory alive through these concerts. And I love that it's billed as the story of HIV AIDS in New York City as you've never heard it before, because this really is a kind of musical odyssey. And I think there's something so beautiful about the idea of remembering through music.
For me, the gift in this film was the moment, because, you know, we're seeing an ensemble of people's personal stories while this backdrop of this concert is kind of playing out. And then we get to hear the songs and we get to hear the lyrics. And it is that moment almost where you get to reflect and really get to inhale and soak in the story you've just heard about somebody's life. So it gives you, it forces the audience that moment to kind of pause and really take that story in, and I think that's the gift of this documentary.
Well, one of the gifts. I think this kind of cinema is really, really important. But Gina, while we are kind of taking stock of where we've come from in terms of the representation of HIV/AIDS on screen, and while we are talking about how music can be used as a channel to remember, how would you feel about revisiting some of the Rent soundtrack?
Because look, it's not a Disney, you know. Knowing you, it could have been Titanic, Disney. Rent is highly acceptable, so yes, I think the audience would agree.
Rent is often met very ambivalently. A lot of people have really strong feelings about this film, and not always for the better. But there is something about the soundtrack that I just love. So as a kind of segue to our show this evening and this body of cinema that remembers and grapples with the trauma of the 80s and the 90s and the AIDS crisis, let's take a listen to the finale from Rent. You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
There is no future, there is no past. Thank God this moment's not the last.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
I've always thought putting together a concert was like walking up a hill, a mountain.
That was 149 Second Avenue, and Eric lived there. It was full of life, full of hope, and full of wonderful music.
I made a list of all the men I knew who had died of AIDS, and I stopped at 35.
This is not going to be easy for me.
And I guess on some level, he was obsessed. There was something that he wanted to say, and he wanted to say it.
I said, I want us to write something about AIDS. I want us to write a song cycle about AIDS.
A lot of it is about trying to keep a connection across from life to death.
One of your strong flood pools.
You are listening to Outtakes, where we are spotlighting queer cinema that deals with the memory of HIV/AIDS in the 80s and the 90s. And that was the trailer for All the Way Through Evening.
And we are exceptionally lucky to have the filmmaker, the writer, director, producer, editor, you name it. And this is how we make films in Australia. Of this gorgeous documentary, Rowan Sprong, who you should know from our interview with him a couple of months back, I think it was, for his fabulous other documentary, Winter at West Beth. Welcome, Rowan.
Thank you for having me back. I was really excited to be asked.
We're excited to have you back in the studio.
Our pleasure. Because, well, we have to talk about this documentary,
yes,
because it's having an encore screening.
Yeah.
The film's not
2012.
No, it's not new. Yeah. So the film was shot sort of in late 2010, and it was released around Australia in late 2012, and sort of did film festivals, and then went to America. So it is 5 years old. It's kind of like having a Rowan retrospective, having it come back.
Why is it now having a comeback?
Well, Roberta Chiabara, who programs the matinee sessions at ACME, had previously programmed Winter at West Beth and had been a bit of a success. And so I think she thought that, All the Way Through Evening could come back as well. And the plan was to sort of coincide it with World AIDS Day, which is December 1st.
Mm. And they're screening it that day, and you've got a Q&A.
I do. I'm doing a Q&A after the 7 p.m. session on December 1st with Nick Holas of the Institute of Many.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, I think actually let's pause there for a moment, because we do want to invite our listeners to participate in the conversation. And we've just had the reason why I've paused now is because we've had a membership come through. So we need to thank
you, Ben from Toorak, for becoming an individual member here at Joy 94.9. Thank you so much. We welcome all our listeners to become members. You can join online, or you can just message in if you are already a member and say hello, join this conversation. We'd love to hear the films that speak to you on this topic. Message in on 0427 Joy 949. Email us on air at joy.org.au.
Let us know, what is your favourite film or what film do you think is the most poignant, the most powerful that deals with this subject matter? And how do you feel about us identifying this new kind of trend in cinema that deals with the kind of memory rather than the re-dramatisation of these events and the kind of grappling with the what we're calling the trauma of that period? So message in on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au. Let us know what you think. And if you've got a question for Rowan, a lot of our listeners will be familiar with Rowan because we did have you in the studio for Winter at West Beth. And in fact, when we did our recap of 2016, Gina listed it as one of the top films of the year.
I did know this. Somebody did reach out and tell me that. And I must admit, I blushed on the spot.
Well, it was true. And SBS also listed you in their top 10 as well, so
It's nice to be on a list. A door list, any kind of list.
While we are talking about Winter at West Beth, there are some similarities between the two documents.
I've seen a few of your Q&A, so I am a fan, and that's why I'm excited that you're here. But Mimi I mean, you
Is it Mimi or Mimi?
Yeah, so it's Mimi.
Mimi.
So like somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle, yeah.
Mimi.
But how does she say it? She says, "Hi, I'm Mimi." Mimi.
Yeah, there you go.
She has a really amazing Brooklyn accent.
Can I just point out that that's the name of one of the leads in Rent as well?
There we go.
Oh, look, we've got one more Rent connection. I feel like every time I'm in this studio, there's something tangentially we can...
That's probably true.
Little Disney.
Gina was right before. At least it's not Disney, exactly. So you count yourself
Monica
lucky.
Yeah.
So I met Mimi first.
Yeah.
And she, I just fell in love with her. She's just one of those people. She became kind of like Maud to my Harold and Maud style. It is a really kind of fair depiction of our relationship.
Well, can I just say, love the opening of this documentary because it starts off with her going, "I got this Australian here filming me for some documentary." Like, it's just, it's her.
Well, I asked her to read out. So I wanted she reaches out to various singers and I was curious to know what was in these emails and these approaches.
Yeah.
And I featured in one and I kind of thought it would be funny to have her read it out. So I was winking at the audience there.
Loved it.
I did want to ask about our introduction to her though, because yes, I thought that was very cute, but it's very dark. She's in this dark room by the piano, all these books. It feels almost like time has forgotten her. That was how I was like, wow, she's really been left behind. Was that intentional?
Well, I went into her space and she literally was just surrounded by scores and scores of music. You know, that was piled high up each side of her wall. And there was something almost Dickensian about that image. She was this person who had this very important labor that they were doing and the rest of the world was moving by quite quickly outside. And, you know, later in the film, certainly she acknowledges that her work is all on, you know, VHS videotape. Mm. And she remarks that the world moves so fast and it sweeps important things under the rug sometimes. And when she sort of made that remark, it kind of helped, I guess, inform how I was going to shoot various other parts of the film.
So how did you actually find her story?
How did that happen?
Yeah, how did you hear about these concerts?
So I'd had a previous film, Tears for Teacher, which is about transgendered school teachers, and I'd taken that film to some festivals in New York and in Long Island, and so I was in New York City at that time, and I was looking for somebody to play piano for an educational piece that I was working on, and it was a really unusual piece of piano, and I just literally was Googling New York and the title of the track, and up came Mimi's amazing sort of Windows 95 website.
But she's got a great web presence.
She does.
That age.
She does. Awesome. She loves webbing. Yeah, she loves, Facebook Live. She offered just Facebook Lives herself on the bus, which is great. But her phone number was on there and I rang her up. I literally just dialed her phone number and she invited me over and I just fell in love with her. Yeah. I can't explain it any better than that. I wish there was something about when I met her, the hairs on my arm just jumped up.
Yeah.
And she'd Googled me before I had come over. And this is life advice for you. She said, "Oh, before you came over, I used the Google on you. And your other movie got 4 stars, but you might be a 4-star kind of guy. And that's something more to aspire to with your life."
That is very sweet.
When she said that to me, I was like, not only am I getting, you know, an amazing documentary character here, but I'm getting free life advice as well, life coaching.
So, but there is something about you that is attracted to the artist, the kind of artistic
totally,
soul.
Totally. Yeah. And I'm not really sure kind of where it comes from. I guess the heart wants what the heart wants.
So if you're looking for an artist for your next documentary, I'm free.
Gina, really?
Those were pretty lovely cookies that you baked earlier. I must admit. Before we came into the studio,
put the grill on and not the bake.
It's always a disaster when I'm in the kitchen. Let's move on. I do want to come back to All the Way Through Evening though, because I found online what people who saw the film 5 years ago when it was screening had to say about the film. You're looking very
I'm frightened.
Anxious.
Wow.
Shall we have a listen?
Do it. Behind door number two.
It was beautiful. The music was fantastic. The people were great. And it was just really nice to see someone had so much care about their friends and their artwork.
I feel like I need to go away from it, sleep on it, and come back. Like, I kind of shocked by the whole thing.
Well, I loved it. I felt like it had this kind of epic feel to it, like I was seeing a very big story.
Very touching, and I was telling a couple of my friends that I'd never wanted the movie to end. I wanted it to go on. Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
There is something epic about it, isn't there?
There is.
There's
And it is, you know, and it is those musical interludes that do get us to stop and just take in what we've seen. And I think that, for me, that's its power. And for me, it's something that actually needs to be seen on a big screen with a surround sound system to really soak in that sound.
Well, I think there's something really important about...
Because how the music and the lyrics...
But the interaction of music and memory, I think, is really fascinating. Yes. Rowan, that's something we want to pick your brain about right after this.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are... exploring queer cinema that remembers, recollects, grapples with HIV/AIDS in the 80s and 90s, and one documentary that does that so exceptionally, like you've never heard it before, in fact, is All the Way Through Evening. And we have the...
I'm Greek and I move my hands. Daniel's like, what? And we have the filmmaker Rowan in with us. And we'd like to remind the audience this is screening at ACME from the 24th of November to the 5th of December with a special World AIDS Day screening where there is a Q&A with yourself.
That's right.
At 7 p.m.
Actually, before we get back to the film, how can people, if they want to... purchase tickets, where do they go?
They can just jump straight onto the ACME website.
ACME
website. Type in ACME All the Way Through Evening or ACME Matinees.
Google the way Mimi just did. Just Google it.
You can use the Google on ACME and you can find it on their website. Oh, so honestly. Good.
You spent a lot of time
with her. I spend a lot of time with her. I mean, she does a really great version of me. So,
really?
Her impersonation of me is better than my impersonation of her, for sure.
I feel like that should be the after credits moment of this film. Right. Now, I was kind of being facetious when I said, as you've never heard it before, but actually there is something to that because the doco film, musical,
whatever you want to call it, I don't mind.
As long as you're talking about it. There is something important about memory and music, and I think the two themes really interact in a really productive way.
Well, I guess each of the musical pieces in the film tells a very, very different aspect of the story. So there's several songs which are featured in the film. One song's called Not Even If I Try, and it's sort of the song of a lost lover, you know, kind of a lover who has lost somebody, you know, wishing or willing them to come back into life. And that's, you know, quite heartbreaking,
isn't it?
It's quite grief-stricken. But then some of it almost has like a magic realist quality to it. I mean, you know, the final song that's featured in the film is quite, is very, very moving. It's called Walt Whitman in 1989, and it sort of sees the poet Walt Whitman return to Earth and walk through the HIV/AIDS ward of Lenox Hill Hospital at the height of the pandemic in New York City, and kind of comfort the men and sail in a boat with them that will travel all the way through evening, which is where the film gets its title. So there's some really beautiful imagery in the lyrics as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But musically, all the pieces are very, very different.
And the other thing we should say is that, I mean, it's kind of layer upon layer, really, because these are...
looking at the four composers and then their friends and their stories.
But these are composers who lost their lives during the 80s and 90s to HIV/AIDS.
Yeah.
To AIDS.
The composers were each friends of Mimi. Mimi was somebody who had worked with them in one way or another. And they left behind music. Some of it was published and some of it was not published. And Mimi tracked down a lot of this music. And a lot of it, you know, did stand the risk of being forgotten.
Yeah.
And she felt it was really, really important that this music, which quite literally tells the story of AIDS arriving in New York, that it not be forgotten and that it be performed and that people remember. And there is something visceral, I guess, about and emotional about experiencing that music almost as though it's happening to your own community right now.
Because it's one thing to remember the people and their stories and their lives, but their art.
Yeah.
As well. And
that's why it's such a moving tribute.
Yeah.
Just there is something about the idea of capturing these beautiful compositions and these beautiful ideas. The idea that you just described in the Walt Whitman in 1989, that poem is just so beautiful. And then when you add the layer on that the person who wrote that is no longer here, and that it's there's kind of one woman who's been championing it in these. It's just it's really gorgeous. Isn't it? And then you've gone and you've captured it in this documentary, and it really is a beautiful homage
because it takes it again out of New York and to a bigger audience, so more voices, more people will hear these songs, and I think that's the nice part about, well, not nice, it's the wrong word, but gorgeous part about it, that not only are these songs going to be remembered amongst these concerts and the people that attend and hear them, but now you've given it an even bigger and broader audience.
With the film, yeah. It's, I mean, I didn't consciously think, you know, I'm carrying the baton for Mimi now, but there is probably an element of that. Totally. You know, she certainly said that to me after the fact.
Yeah.
Mm. But by the same token, you know, she's still got a lot of youthful spunk and she's still doing what she does.
I Googled her and she does lots
of
stuff.
Was that a Boston?
Terrible.
Was that supposed to be a Boston accent?
A bit of my Greek heritage in the background. But she does lots of, lots of causes for breast cancer. And, you know, she's probably just paying the bills.
Oh, totally, totally. She's... you know, she's on Section 8 New York, which is, you know, subsidized housing. And she's a big believer in subsidized housing. She has devoted her life to collecting music that she feels is important but that otherwise might have been forgotten.
It is very brave as a filmmaker to rest your documentary entirely on her shoulders.
As I say, I just fell in love with her. I just knew that she had kind of enough charisma to carry a film. You know, and actually, you know, when you're a documentarian and you try and chase somebody around with your camera and you have to sort of anticipate what they're going to do next, generally you have a sense. You can sort of see people's eyes dart and move around the room and you learn to follow people with a camera. But Mimi was completely off the chain. So, you know, there was a sort of spontaneity about having her involved in the film. She doesn't kind of pack any punches. She's very cool.
And it was her and her circle and her home and her space that inspired Winter at West Beth.
Well, yeah, so it was after making All the Way Through Evening that I was introduced to her partner, Ilsa Gilbert, who then is one of the main characters.
Interesting.
And this if you look carefully in All the Way Through Evening, you can spot Ilsa.
Can you?
Yes, you can. She's at the concert. Yeah, you look great for the eagle-eyed amongst us.
Wow. That's gorgeous. So... Yeah, look, I think it is a really fitting tribute, and I think how do you feel about us putting it in this category that we're observing? Does it make you nervous? Because I do feel like we are starting to see in the last 5 to 10 years, perhaps not starting anymore, but slowly emerging this body of work that doesn't aim to dramatize, doesn't aim to tell us exactly what happened, but instead shifts the focus onto the importance of memory and the importance of grappling with what happened here today.
Yeah, how people today remember or honor or, you know, respond. I think timeline-wise, there was definitely a bunch of films that came out at the same time. So I think We Were Here was probably the first one. But then All the Way Through Evening and How to Survive a Plague came out at the same time. And Vito as well was out around then as well. So it was interesting that there was a big wave of them. I think each of those films, those other films that I've mentioned, though, they're about political activists whose, you know, activity is often kind of city-wide. And it's quite, you know... a reactive and aggressive politics, which is, you know, a necessary politics in the face of such, you know, in the face of such obliteration. Mimi's activism is a quieter form of activism, but it's a no less important form of activism. And it's a very much, it's about how much you love your friends and your community and how the community leans in closer together in times of crisis. And it celebrates that and honouring those friendships.
Yeah. Wow. It really is an important documentary. So fantastic that it's screening again. Gina, you've got the details
there. Yeah, so ACME, 24th of November, 5th of December, as we said, special screening on Friday, the 1st of December at 7 p.m, where there will be a Q&A with yourself and Nick Hollis.
That's correct. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us again. It's been a pleasure to have you in the studio again. And we'll have to... What is next for you?
I'm taking my time. Actually, I'll be honest, I have been taking my time on my next project. So it's a documentary about Annie Anxiety, who is, or Little Annie, as she's also known, also was at one time known as Annie and the Asexuals. She's kind of a punk figure from New York from the late 70s who's a bit of a wild child and has a really, really interesting memoir that I just fell in love with and thought, how could we adapt this for cinema? So that's awesome. Where I'm at the
moment. So we're going back to New York.
I'm going back to New York, but if all the cards line up, the film funding clouds, you know, arrive and part and the rainbows appear, then I actually want to shoot a whole bunch of it in Melbourne and a whole bunch of it in Nevada. We're going west.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll have to have you back in the studio then. But what we're going to do now is we're going to play one of the songs that's featured. Now, you'll have to forgive me. It's not the same version that's featured in the doco, but that's all the more reason that people need to go and see the doco.
You need to see this on a big screen with surround sound and really just get lost in those songs and the music.
Now, I'm not an opera person. I'm not an opera fan, but there is something about hearing it in this context that makes that is so engaging because it works. It works so well as a tribute, which is what this documentary is. And I just think there is something about the way that it does pay homage and that it does remember
beautifully, respectfully, just delicious.
So we're going to play Walt Whitman in 1989, which I think was my favourite piece in the documentary. Can you tell us again who it's by? It's by Chris.
Right. So Chris de Blasio wrote the music, yes. And he passed away of HIV/AIDS-related illness very shortly afterwards. He premiered this piece of work at Mimi's very first HIV/AIDS concert or music of HIV/AIDS concert. And the words are by Perry Brass, who's still very much writing today. In fact, he and I share a birthday. He's a dear friend. And the song sees the American poet Walt Whitman returning to Earth in 1989 and walking through the hospital wards of Lenox Hill, where scores of young men are dead or dying of HIV/AIDS.
It's such a tragically beautiful idea for a song. This version is sung by Michael Dash. So thank you again, Rowan. You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
Walt Whitman has come down today to the hospital room. He rocks back and forth in the crisis. He says it's good we haven't lost our closeness and cries as each one is taken. He has written many lines about these years, the disfigurement of young men and the wars of hard tongues and closed minds. The body in pain will bear such nobility, but words have the edge of poison when spoken bitterly. Now he takes a dying man in his arms and tells him how deeply flows the river that takes the old man and his friends this evening.
And we'll sail together.
find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, the home of queer cinema, where this evening we are looking at films that grapple with the memory of the AIDS crisis in the 80s and the 90s. And this is an emergent genre of film which has started to emerge within the past 5 to 10 years. Mm. So we just had Rowan Spung in the studio. Rowan is the director of All the Way Through Evening. He was identifying a number of films that came out around 2011, heralded perhaps by We Were Here, which really shifted representation from re-dramatizations to grappling with the here and now and what happened in the 80s and 90s and how that affects our lives today and our consciousness as a community. And I think All the Way Through Evening, which of course is screening at ACME later this month and indeed into the next month, into December, I think it positions itself really well within this kind of genre of this emergent genre. But another film which does so, and indeed a fiction. It's a very autobiographical, isn't it?
I feel like it is autobiographical, especially when you start to learn more about the filmmaker Vincent.
The film is, of course, After Louis.
After Louis. So After Louis follows Sam, who's played by Alan Cumming, an artist and activist from ACT UP who lived through the early years of HIV and AIDS, and he's a man scarred and still struggling with survivor guilt. He meets a bewildered young generation, you know, carefree gay men. He struggles to understand that world. But when he, you know, meets the seductive young Braden, an intergenerational kind of relationship blossoms that kind of makes him kind of, I don't know, it's a bit of a reawakening for his art, for himself and his perspective on how he sees the younger generation and them reflecting on his history.
Yeah, look, I love that you pick up on the intergenerational element in this film, because I feel like this film is in many ways about community and about the relationship between one gay man and another gay man. So the relationship between gay men, but also the relationship between one generation and the next generation. And in particular, the relationship between the generation that lived through the 80s and 90s and really fought, were politically motivated, to fight for, a cure for medication for anything during the 80s and 90s, for governmental action, and that was indeed the generation that the filmmaker Vincent was a part of. He was a founding member of ACT UP, which was nothing if not political.
Which saved lives, absolutely.
It's about that generation and their relationship to the next generation.
But also,
who didn't live through the 80s and 90s. And I think this film makes the point that they can be seen as taking so much of what happened and the kind of terrible struggle of that period for granted.
I know when I watched it, I never like to read anything about a film before I sit down and watch it, so I'll watch the film straight through and then I'll go and look, you know, learn more about the filmmaker, learn how they made the film, you know, start reading stuff afterwards. And I know when I watched it, I thought, yes, I can relate to this story and I know the message of the protagonist. And I was thinking in the back of my mind, I wonder if a younger audience watching this will feel like a message is being rammed down their throats, because at times it does feel like we are talking down to a younger generation, because that's what the character himself at his lowest point is
Alan
doing.
Cumming,
Alan Cumming. He is pretty much screaming at the younger generation going, you should be thanking us, you should be thanking us, you have no idea what we've gone through.
Yeah.
And I read this, I basically looked up what Vincent had done, and he had this statement which kind of captures exactly why he made this film. And I'm going to read you this quote. And he said, I began working on After Louis at a moment in which I found myself politically at odds with a gay community in a state of accelerated assimilation, which I fear ignores the complexities of the modern gay, lesbian and transgender experience, threatening to regulate our history to a shameful past. past, I grew increasingly aware that a younger generation of gay men would never experience the benefits of the great gay sexual revolution and feared the older ones could only remember how it was.
And we
you feel that message way through.
Yeah, it definitely comes through. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, a lot of people have struggled with this film. It is slow. It does feel politically motivated and it does feel preachy at times.
And you know what? I think a different age audience might feel that.
Oh, of course. I feel it. Yeah. And I'm the age that's being scolded in this film. I nearly called it a documentary. In this film, I feel it. I agree with a lot of what the film has to say.
Yeah.
And can I say, I think that's why I enjoyed it, because I did not approach this film as a narrative or fictional piece.
I thought I was watching a kind of documentary to begin with, and then realised, oh, hang on, we've gone somewhere
else. Well, I knew who Vincent was when I sat down to watch this film, so I knew that it was going to be politically motivated, and I watched it as I would watch and with the same expectations that I would have were I watching a documentary, were I watching an autobiography. That's what I wanted to see when I saw this film. And I really do feel like that's what we got. And we actually did sit down with Vincent when the film screened at the Queer Screen Film Festival a couple of months ago up in Sydney. And there was this beautiful moment where we were talking about the process of making this film. Do you remember that scene where Alan Cumming is kind of scrawling all of these names
on the wall, the red writing? Yeah,
quite an emotional scene. But Vincent was talking about the process of making that scene and how cathartic it was for him. And I like that, what he has to say about that process in light of what we're looking at this evening, which is how films remember and grapple with the history and the trauma of that period in the 80s and 90s and the AIDS crisis. Because, you know, there is kind of layer upon layer here. We have the character, you know, on a fictional level struggling with these issues. But then, like, that is just really breathing life to the struggle of the filmmaker, which he doesn't fully apprehend until he sits down to make this film.
There's a lot of different interpretations of when he comes back to his loft and starts writing that memorial wall. But for me, it was about him confronting his invisibleness, and he was making it visible. You know, we were shooting it. It was a very intense day. At one point, you know, we had arranged for Alan, you know, he had a certain amount of names that he was writing, and then the set designer was going to come in and write some more, and Alan was going to come in and everything. And I had the whole list of names, and these were all, I mean, 75% of those names were my friends.
Yeah,
and I had encouraged him. I just told Alan, you know, just any names that come to mind, you know, it's fine. You know, you lived through it. You have, you know, well, you lost. And what happened was, he got to the end of what he was supposed to write, and he just said, "Give me a name and give me a name." And I kept giving him names to the list and spelling them. I mean, the sweat was pouring off of myself and my cinematographer, and we were kind of, it was beyond nerve wracking when he finished. And, you know, he kind of fell to the corner of the floor, and I just fell to the floor, and I just cried for uncontrollably for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Because it was the first time in a really long time that I had made visible what had happened, and have it manifested through somewhat of a piece of art. You know, it was important for me, you know, as Sam, who was a painter, that moment manifests itself in a visual, you know, in a painting, so to speak.
I just love the idea of this process, this filmmaking process, and how cathartic it is. And I love it as well because there, you know, at the same time as the film is dealing with this character who is using his art to mediate his pain and to mediate his trauma and to deal with the memory, we have the filmmaker doing it at the same time, dealing with exactly those thoughts and exactly those feelings. And that is one theme that runs across all of these films and documentaries that we're looking at tonight. Mimi Stern-Wolf, who is spotlighted in All the Way Through Evening, she's an artist. She's a pianist. Music is her art. And likewise, in We Were Here, this documentary that I think is just the most touching documentary I think I've ever seen, really.
Yeah,
features a number of characters, a number of real-life people who are bearing witness. But amongst them is this fellow called Daniel Goldstein, who is an HIV-positive artist who lost a number of friends and lovers during those periods. And you see towards the end of the documentary some of his art pieces and sculptures, which are his way of grappling with the memory and with the trauma. And I think I just think it's such a fascinating theme that these pieces of art themselves, these films, that they kind of capture and then pay homage to.
The thing is, we were here. I was so glad you made me go back to this film. And it was, you know what? This was the hardest one for me to watch.
It's a hard documentary.
This week.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
Because so many, those five characters where we get to see, and this is the, and we were here. So we've looked at two films that look at the New York story.
Yeah.
We were here, we need to remember, is the San Francisco story.
Yes.
Of the crisis at the time, and them re-sharing those memories and the memories from the flower guy and the nurse who took care of everyone. We needed to go back and watch this film, and I really hope people do go. I know it's a hard film to watch, but it is.
On a technical level, can I just say, I think I messaged you when I was, because I sat down over the weekend to rewatch it as well.
Mm.
On a technical level, it gets documentary making right.
So beautiful.
Like no other documentary, it uses the stories of a few key people to tell the story of an isolated community, and then by extension to tell the story of communities around the world, because the story resonates with LGBTIQ communities around the world.
And that's the thing, there's a moment where they talk about the drugstore window where the Polaroid pictures are posted.
Oh, that's tragic.
Saying, watch out guys, there's something out there,
and the
something
way
you don't forget.
The way he talks about it and motions to his own body. And that's a fellow called, I think that was Ed, who I have to say,
Ed Wolf.
Yes. Who I have to say, I think as a character resonates with me most, just because I see the most of myself, I think, in him. Whereas I know that you feel the same way about the nurse, Eileen.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, I've heard it called a love story, and it really is. It is a love letter to the community. And, you know, It's one of the hardest films to go back and watch, but one of the most rewarding. And this is where, you know, David Weisman, when I was talking at the start of the show, it's the message I needed to hear from him, and listening to an interview going, you know, it's him trying to understand.
Yeah. It's this grappling, this exploration.
And, you know, they still can't understand it, but it's them trying to understand, and that's why they're telling these stories still.
If you had a bus ticket, it better be saying San Francisco, because that was the place to come.
I think a lot of us came out here because we didn't quite fit where we were.
I like the people here. They just seem more open. And I always wanted to meet a nice blonde surfer.
If you took a bunch of young men and said, have as much sex as you can have, how much sex would they have? A lot of sex. All of America was feeling very confident that you could be much more sexual, and that was okay.
'81 was a big year. That is when everything changed. I remember looking in the window of Star Pharmacy, and there were these little Polaroid photographs. Watch out, guys, there's something out there.
The first time I heard about AIDS, I think it was called the gay cancer. We had friends who were dying right at the beginning of the epidemic.
I was hanging blood one day in the hospital, and the infectious disease fellow came in and said, Eileen, why don't you put gloves on? We don't know what this is.
How are you getting it? Who are you getting it from? Who's giving it to who?
Everybody was reading the obituaries because they went from like this to like this.
Our principal response was food banks and care programs, and it was a response that America should be proud of.
It changed people's view of the gay community in a huge way.
Again and again, in every situation, there's lesbians there leading the fight.
None of my friends are around for the beginning. So I want to tell their story as much as I want to tell my story.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of Queer Cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we've been looking at this emergent genre of film that really grapples with HIV/AIDS, the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 80s and the early 90s, and the memory and trauma of that period. I think we've touched on some really important works.
And, you know, celebrating, of course, the local Australian work, with Rowan just joined us, his documentary All the Way Through Evening, which is at ACME 24th of November to 5th of December. We really encourage an audience to go see that on a big screen.
Well, that's it for another week of Outtakes. You're listening to Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.